And finally, we have Dr. Liza Wick from UCSF talking about readmissions.
So thank you so much. The purpose of my talk is really to try to convince you that you should still care about readmissions. We've been hearing about them for a long time. To just highlight the difference between surgical and medical readmissions so you're smart about preventing them and present an approach for prevention. I don't have any disclosures. So I think we all feel like readmissions are old news. They are part of the Affordable Care Act. 2010, I looked at the colorectal readmission rate in a Blue Cross database, and obviously it was off the chart. That's actually before my older son was born, and even before both of my sons were born, and they're this big now. So it's been a while, and it's been cooking. So should we still care? I just want to argue, yes, that there's a kind of a second act right now for readmissions. I don't know if anyone here went to Michael Porter's talk about payment reform and kind of where we're going, but I think some sort of alternative payment models, it's going to change. And right now, what's out there for us to participate in is the Bundled Care Payment Initiative Advance, BCPI Advance, for those of you whose hospitals might be looking at it. And if you look at these and you look at your data, readmissions are going to matter. So the bundle payment, just the nuts and bolts of it, it's when you are looking at being reimbursed for a prospective period of time, so a 90-day episode of care, and it's to incentivize us to manage our patients after that anchor admission of surgery. And so this means that we're going to be responsible for readmissions, for home health, for SNF use, all of that we're going to have to get a handle on. Obviously not the surgeon alone, but the surgeon as a team with your delivery system. So this is just we are participating in BCPI Advance for major bowel and started to look at how we were going to strategize to succeed in this model. And this just sort of maps out the episode that we're going to be responsible for. And we can't do much about our anchor stay, about that initial stay, that's sort of a fixed price. But then you look at everything that's happening in those 90 days afterwards, our home health, SNF stay, and we started to put a tag to all of those. And that readmission is a major driver of that 90-day cost. This is the data we got back from CMS when we were looking to participate, and this is our historic data for this general surgery population of our 90-day costs. And you can see we averaged about $65,000 a patient. And I just want you to look at the red. And that, everything above the blue is what the levers you'd have to succeed in these payment models. And that red is readmission. So that's a big chunk of what we can modify in these models. So we're participating, and we were incentivized to reduce our costs. And our target price is $48,000 a patient. So we really need to improve that red. This is just another view of our data. I'm just really, again, highlighting of all the episodes we got back from CMS where we were sort of evaluating how we could do in this model. Again, red is readmissions. And you can see that readmission is driving a lot of our variation and cost. And I think it's just important as you think about this to really understand the data. And so you're at the table because when you do these models, you're going to be sitting there with your population health, your hospital leadership, and they don't understand surgery. And they'll go back, and there was this paper on the left that was sort of the initial thing that got the readmission bandwagon going. I think it was in about 2006 or 7 from BU. And it was it got a lot of press, and it sort of led to all the readmission metrics in the Affordable Care Act. And they came forward, there were surgical patients in it, it was administrative data, but they said that that readmissions were either exacerbation of comorbidities or lack of care coordination. And so that got so much traction, but there was a lot, I think we all understood in our population, it was really probably complications. And so, you know what, if you have surgical site infections, if you have AKI, if you have a VTE, you can do all the care coordination you want in the world, but those patients are still going to come back because it's medically necessary. So then Carl Bilmoria looked subsequently, I think this was about 2015 or so, and looked at surgical patients alone. And in that paper, it's in JAMA, and anyone can look it up, that it's very clear that that in surgical patients, complications are driving this. So I really just want to say that all the talks that preceded me are really the way to address readmissions. I don't want to repeat anything, but You want to get your SSI bundle, VTE bundle, CAUTI bundle, ERAS pathway, all these things right, implemented well, and you'll see that needle move. Of course, you know, as you think about it, you also want to pay attention to the details. I'm not saying that discharge instructions, appropriate discharge location, post-op follow-up, easy follow-up, all of things, those things are important, just as they are in the medical literature, but they're not what's driving our problem. So I just want to emphasize that we still need to care, make sure you understand what the root cause of these surgical readmissions are, so when you're working with your hospital leadership, you can be powerful and strong and hold to what needs to be done and don't get sort of swayed down the medical path. I think more of these alternative payment models are going to keep coming, and more of us are going to have to be part of them, and we're going to need to test them and just see how they work and be at the table to modify them down the line. And I think we just all need to continue to strive to reduce surgical complications, and these will come down as well. Thank you.
So I'm not going to make all the panelists come up here, but what I'll do is disconnect the microphone, and if anybody wants to come and ask some questions, and then the individual speaker can address it from the floor. Yes, sir.
Good morning. Nice presentation. I'm Dr. Salinas, a surgeon from Lima, Peru. After 4 years of using black box in our OR, and after these years, we have seen that medical errors are more frequently than we thought. The black box has helped us to analyze them, correct them, and make a better, a safer operating room. My question to all of you is, are you using black boxes here in the United States? Because I would like to share protocols about it.
Yeah, how about Dr. Eibling? You want to address that?
So, I'll need some definition of black box. So,
yeah.
What? Video recording in the operating room.
The thing is that almost the same as in the aircrafts. I mean, what I have seen in our operating room is that black boxes in the air companies prevent another aircraft. It won't happen immediately, but it will prevent. And in the analysis of the black boxes, 50% are human errors and 50% are mechanical. But in the OR, the majority of medical errors are humans.
We'll have Dr. Lizawick answer that question.
That's a great point. I know lots of people are interested in either video or audio recording in the OR. We have a lot of privacy laws that make it sometimes hard to implement, and it has to go back to revising the consents and the patients here. So people are definitely interested. When we rebuilt the ORs at Hopkins, we built all that capacity in, but it never got disseminated because of the issues.
So you don't have to.
So yeah. The Human Factor Ergonomics Society has a yearly meeting on healthcare. And in that world of human factors, there are investigators who actually do that kind of work for a living, and they find exactly as you pointed out. And for example, the data on non-technical skills in the operating room, that data is quite strong and supports exactly what you say.
All right, let's do the next question, please. Thank you.
Not so much, it's more of a comment than a question. Thank you to all the presenters. Thank you for bringing the IVC filter. Sherry Kavanaugh from Michigan, sorry, I forgot to introduce myself. Thank you, and I just want to piggyback. If you put in a filter when they should be rare, please schedule the post-op appointment for vascular interventional radiology, whoever put it in, to get it out. Please, 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 and thank you so much for bringing that.
Hi, Julia Coleman, University of Colorado, Denver. Dr. Neal, thank you for a great talk. I appreciate you bringing up the concept of screening ultrasounds. I think part of the controversy around screening ultrasounds is whether the VTEs that you're picking up are actually clinically significant. And so I think what many practices struggle with is you sort of have two options with screening ultrasounds, which is you do them for everyone, and then many that you pick up are not clinically significant. And so the cost, the way that we get dinged, et cetera, the burden of that. On the other end, you can do sort of these risk-based stratifications like you talked about, not just for chemoprophylaxis strategies, but for screening strategies. But then you're inherent to whatever the bias is of your screening tool for patients that you're capturing. And so I'm wondering if you can comment more on that and talk about what the practices are at your own hospital. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's insanely complex and probably not fair to the remaining time to delve into too much detail, other than to say that I think that the idea of targeted screening has its appeal. However, an appropriate risk-based assessment and risk-based strategy that accounts for the continuum and changes in patient care could probably obviate the need for surveillance, right? And utilizing protocol and disease-specific and surgery-specific screening modalities, some of which still need to be validated, could probably overcome some of those inherent challenges that you present. The surveillance bias is real. The more that we look, the more we will find. That has quality implications for us, certainly. And certainly we do see the complications associated with anticoagulation in patients that should not perhaps necessarily have received that. And so I think that I would direct this really more at devising better risk assessment tools that are not based on screening or surveillance, but on broader protocols that are disease-specific, risk modified. So we do not routinely screen in our trauma patients that are high risk. We do have a protocol in our spinal cord injury patients, but I'll tell you that presents exactly this surveillance bias. We look for more and we find more, but we do not utilize it in our global trauma or polytrauma patients, and I'm not aware of a surgical practice beyond spine that utilizes that as a screening protocol.
Two quick questions. One's for Dr. Evans from South Carolina. Any recommended, I do a lot of outpatient surgery, lots of hernias, et cetera. Any recommended iPhone or Android apps for patients to share their pictures or that you can think of?
So there are a number of companies that will sell you products that are much more designed to be comprehensive pre-op, post-op sort of care coordination. There are very few out there that are targeted specifically at SSI. I'm happy to talk to you offline about the work that we've been doing. It's not available commercially, but I certainly would be willing to talk to you about whether or not you'd like to be a test site for us.
Okay, thanks. And then another quick question regarding normal saline. I do a tiny bit of trauma, and then, you know, the paradigm is, of course, normal saline for head injury patients, and a good alternative for, and then, of course, you know, they're old and they get acute kidney injury. Any recommended other fluid alternatives?
Yeah, no. You know, sometimes we make our own. I mean, pharmacy do it. You know, I do think that the jury is no longer out with regards to the detriment of saline, and we're going to have to come up with other types of isotonic or even slightly hypertonic that are more balanced in nature to deal with the head injured patient.
Huge war at my institution now. Nail polish in the OR, yes or no?
Yeah, and everywhere else, and then it goes even further to gel versus regular nail polish, and there's just no data that I'm aware of. I don't know. I invite anyone here to take that on.
There's not going to be a consensus conference.
I don't, not anytime soon. Right.
Scott Grant from New York. I just had a few quick practical questions. I thought that all of the sessions were really great. I'm presenting the data and things that we should be doing. But in terms of implementation of some of them, we've talked about prehab and strong for surgery and nutritional support and preventing VTEs. But what supplements do you give for nutrition? What probiotics do you give? What exercise recommendations do you give? Do you give preoperative heparin or Lovenox if you continue it postoperatively only while they're in the hospital or when they go home? I know that's a lot of questions, whatever people want to handle.
That's a lot of questions. I don't know if I want to handle any of them. But basically, at least my experience talking to people nationally and then internationally, what's available and what we see studies on in the UK is very different than what we're able to do here. So the studies that I presented relative to prehab are based either at McGill or in the UK. And they have tons of money and lots of bikes, and they're doing CPETs, and they're doing all these other studies. What we'll be able to do here, I think, will be very different. But I currently, what I do pre-op, I say, hey, how much are you walking? Oh, 10 minutes a couple times a week. Okay, double it, you know? And I do a kind of functional assessment. How much can you do? Double it. You have 2 or 3 weeks before we're getting to the OR. Please do more. And usually engage the family in that. But we don't really have great standards yet either. We don't know what we're going to do to our surgical outcomes. As far as supplements, I'll refer you to the paper specifically. There is a discussion of immunonutrition in that, and it's too much for this session, I'm sure. But we do try to get people assessed and then decide. Really, the easiest, most straightforward recommendation is high protein. So when you're working with people, particularly if they have GI disease, sometimes it's tough. You need to refer them to a low-fiber diet, but they can still get protein in, and there are a lot of good supplements right now available just commercially. VT prophylaxis?
Hina Rajdev, New York. The practical aspect of it, the practical aspect of it, that exercise therapy, right, is prehab. How do we do it? How do we, are the insurance companies going to pay for it? Where do you refer them? And who does the referral?
Yeah, we don't yet. So
and I would say that what's on the horizon is intensive biometric monitoring. That's what's going to happen. There's going to be accountability for whether or not you actually did your prehab. Patient tracking is going to happen. Definitely. It's already happening. People are using fitness trackers personally. But that data, we're going to figure out how to use that data and track that data. And you better believe the insurance companies are going to be following it.
I have a question for post-discharge instruction for the patients. Often we give them a ton of documents and just throw it in the car and never look at it. And then they show up in the next hospital ER and say, why you never call me? It's like, well, I didn't know what to do. So how do you incentivize your patient to participate in their own care?
I'll take that one. You know, I think a lot of it starts in the preoperative area. You know, when we talk to the patients in clinic, we really empower them and their family that they need to take ownership of their care. And there are different philosophies about providing too much information and overloading them versus not enough. But I think it's just empowering them in the beginning and making sure they know that what they do and the effort they put in are going to have significant improvements in their outcomes. Take a couple more questions. We're over time, so last question. Yeah.
So Dr. Consumer Reports and Dr. Frontline tells us that all of these supplements have no standardization, that we are recommending the probiotics, the whatever. And does it bother anybody that, you know, we give these things orally and not rectally? just a comment.
You mean the nutritional supplements or the probiotics?
Well, some of the nutritional supplements, but as well as the probiotics.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that bothers me about the nutritional supplement literature is all industry-sponsored. And so you have to really read that literature with a grain of salt. And the probiotics, you know, as a colorectal surgeon, there's 100,000 out there. I tell the patients, I'm not sure it will harm you, but we have absolutely no evidence to suggest that it'll help. So that's my spiel. Well, but the individual, you want to comment? You want to comment? It's just the formulations. But here.
Yeah, what Tracy is saying is absolutely true. There are a million different kinds of probiotics out there, and symbiotics and prebiotics and so forth, and therefore it becomes very difficult to recommend a specific one. I guess if you go back and look at the individual studies, but a lot of times the studies are done with things that are not available here in the U.S., or they're made specifically for the study. So that is a messy part of that area.
All right, last one.
Thank you. Chuck Plain, Los Angeles, great panel. With regards to the UV sterilization of the rooms, is this a terminal clean? Is it done after dirty cases? What's it done to your turnover times?
Yeah, so great question. All that data was in hospital rooms, and it was specifically to reduce multidrug resistant organisms. There is not parallel data in operating rooms, and your concern is absolutely clear. As a terminal clean at the end of the day, that's easy, and a lot of places actually do something like that. But if you're trying to do it between cases, it could be too long.
Yeah, we do it at night, right? I mean, I think it happens, we don't know it overnight. Yeah. The blue lights,
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.